Yeah. So that's, I don't even know what the question was that got me down that rant, but.
Is there any more bourbon hunting left? Hey everyone, it's episode 318 of Bourbon Pursuit, the podcast featuring news, reviews, and interviews with people making the bourbon whiskey industry happen. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Coleman, and before we start today's episode, talking about dusty bourbon, here's your weekly bourbon news update. The legendary Stitzelweller Distillery begins a new chapter in its 86-year history with the opening of the Garden and Gun Club. This destination cocktail bar is inspired by Garden Club magazine's hospitality franchise, and it will be located on the second floor of the Stitzelweller Distillery. It will be offering unique food and drink experiences along the Kentucky Bourbon Trail. The space offers a curated drink list, including a Blade & Bow 22-year-old tasting experience and a unique bar menu that is a modern-day take on classic Southern favorites, developed by executive chef Ann Kim, and will have a capacity for around 60 people. Wild Turkey has announced the launch of its new global creative campaign and platform called Trust Your Spirit, and it features the brand's creative director, Matthew McConaughey. This also includes a brand new rollout design of Wild Turkey 101. Now moving on to bourbon release news. Wild Turkey has announced Master's Keep 1. This is a project where Jimmy and Eddie Russell both had a hand in, as Eddie now celebrates his 40th year at Wild Turkey. It combines Jimmy's love for 8-to-10-year-old bourbon with Eddie's passion for older whiskeys around the 14-year mark. Both of these were mingled together and went into a second barrel aging process using new, toasted, and charred barrels. This rested also in Tyrone G. Warehouse. This will have a retail price of around $175. Well, the toasted barrel train continues because 8th generation Beam distiller Freddie No is launching a new expression called Basil Hayden Toast. The difference is that this consists of an entirely new brown rice forward mash bill and a toasted barrel finish. This is bottled at the standard 80 proof of Basil Hayden and has a price tag of $50. Heaven Hill Distillery has announced the 8th release of Old Fitzgerald Bottled and Bond, with the fall release of the 2021 that will be 11 years old. And these come in those really nice fancy decanters. The barrels used in this release were filled in the spring of 2010 and rested in Warehouse EE. These were bottled at 100 proof and has a retail price of $110. Barrel Craft Spirits has released Barrel Bourbon Batch 30. This is a blend of straight bourbon whiskeys that are 5, 6, 9, 10, 11, and 15 years old that are coming from Tennessee, Kentucky, Indiana, and Wyoming. The 5-year-old barrels are from Indiana, and then the Tennessee barrels are 6, 9, 10, 11, and 15 years old. Finally, a wheated bourbon from both Kentucky and Wyoming were added to the blend. This is bottled at cask strength, which is 117.32 proof, and has a suggested retail price of $90. Old Forester is releasing its newest expression of the 117 series. This is the label that adorns Jackie Zycan's signature, and it will be called Warehouse K. This limited edition release is sold in 375ml bottles and pays homage to Old Forester's home place located on Whiskey Row. Warehouse K has gained almost a cult-like following for featuring a blend of barrels aged on different floors. Constructed back in 1953, Warehouse K uses heat cycling and has long been one of Old Forester's favorite places for single barrel expressions. Warehouse K will be exclusively available at Old Forester Distilling Company and at select Kentucky retailers at a suggested retail price of $50. So, what is a dusty bourbon? Well, really, it's just old bourbon. The idea is that these were bottles that used to sit on the shelves and collect dust. Nowadays, we consider them rare gems, and lots of bourbon hunters go crazy looking for them. Unfortunately, the days of finding a 1980s old grand on the shelf are pretty much long gone. But we sit down and analyze what makes a dusty bourbon a dusty. There's lots of factors to consider on why a bourbon has changed so much in recent decades, and we give our takes on what some of those key factors might be. With that, enjoy today's episode, and now here's Fred Minnick with Above the Char.
I'm Fred Minnick, and this is Above the Char. This week's idea comes from longtime listener and our good friend, Alan Channel, or you could pronounce it Chanel, but I'm pretty sure it's Channel. Alan, if I got that wrong, blame Kenny. But he, Alan, writes me on fredminnick.com. That's fredminnick.com. And he has a couple questions. I'm going to go ahead and choose one I think is really good and we can all learn from. And that is, when a distiller makes a variety of whiskey, be it bourbon, rye, weeded bourbon, wheat whiskey, whatever, do they tend to use the same yeast strain, or is there no correlation? Well, first of all, let's put these distillers in groups. You have your craft distillers, which, I mean, I'll be honest with you, craft distillers do some wild, wild west stuff, and they'll break up yeast like nobody's business. So they will indeed like use different strains of yeast and different types and all that, and they'll do all kinds of experimentation because they're just finding their footing. However, the larger distillers use typically one yeast outside of like Four Roses, which has several yeast strains, and that was basically because of a Seagram's protocol that always had 10 recipes going into a batch, and every time that they had a distillery close and they lost that recipe style, they essentially created a different yeast strain to compensate for the loss of a distillery. So Beam, Heaven Hill, same yeast, and it's basically the same yeast across the board with these things. Now, I do know that yeast reacts very differently with grains. And so when someone has a yeast that they perfected and created specifically for a rye whiskey, it doesn't always taste the same. It doesn't always have that same kind of powerful effect as it does with the bourbon. A really good example is MGP, which is using the V yeast. That V yeast is the same V yeast that Four Roses has. And it's basically, it was created to deal with like rye mash bills and high rye content. And so when you use that V yeast in some of their wheated recipes, it can taste kind of funky. But you know, sometimes that's a good funk. I do like me some funk from time to time. But I hope that answers your question, Alan. And if I butchered your name, let me know. I want to make sure I pronounce it right next time. But I appreciate you writing, Alan. If you want to be like Alan and have a chance of me butchering your name on air, hit me up on fredminnick.com. That's fredminnick.com. Click that contact button, and I'll be happy to read your question if it makes the cut. That's going to do it for this week, folks. Be safe out there. Cheers.
From their bar to yours, Chad and Sarah of the popular YouTube channel It's Bourbon Night bring you their favorite at-home old-fashioned mix with the new Elemental Elixirs Golden Hour Syrup. It's a custom-made syrup with notes of bold black tea, warm spices, and orange zest. All you need is your favorite whiskey and ice. No bitters needed. One bottle makes 16 drinks, so that's only $1 cocktail before you add your own whiskey. They can also be enjoyed in other cocktails or spirits, mocktails, coffee, tea, and anything you can think of. It's crafted locally in Lexington, Kentucky, and you can get your bottle now at whiskeyambitions.com.
It's that time again to get bourbon strong with Give270. Purchase your $50 tickets for your chance to win from our 50 bourbon prizes. Don't miss out on rare bottles and grand prizes like the legendary Pappy Set, a Weller Rainbow, and the Blood Oath Trilogy. Hurry, only 3,000 tickets are available. Single bottle winners go back in for the grand prize draw. Will you win the ultimate Pappy Set or one of our other incredible prizes? Get your tickets now at Give270.org. Charitable gaming license ORG 000273.
It's that time of the year where everybody's starting to make their vacation plans on visiting Kentucky, the mecca of bourbon. And if you are coming to Kentucky, you need to make sure you visit us at Pursuit Spirits in Louisville. We're right in the heart of Clifton, near Butchertown and Nulu, and only just a few miles away from downtown Louisville. But when you do come, you need to book your experience to go do our whole shebang. This is the one that's really the star of the show. You get a full-on tasting. You get to do your own personal barrel selection experience. And you get to grab a whiskey thief and fill your bottle directly from the barrel. We're doing something completely brand new that nobody else is doing here in bourbon country. Plus, you get a free sweet tasting glass at the end of it. I guarantee you, you're going to end up being one of the many people that's also leaving us a 5-star review. So make sure you come and check us out. You can book your reservation by going to pursuitspirits.com and clicking the Visit Us button. Welcome back, everybody, to this very special edition of Bourbon Pursuit, where if you're watching on camera, you might be looking at some of the bottles we have lined up here going, what are these old bottles? And This is actually a very fun episode.
It's a rare opportunity.
It is a very rare opportunity.
It says right here on the tag.
Because today we're going to be talking about Dusties. This is something that I've been wanting to talk about for quite a long time. Not only because it's hard to understand, we thought it like, oh, can we get like some size scientist on here to talk about what's the chemical makeup? And it's like, I don't really think a lot of scientists are like getting funded to go and figure this sort of stuff out. But it is fun to sit here and think about theories and think about what distilling techniques were and how things are different, because there's no doubt about it. When you're tasting old whiskey, it definitely does taste different.
Mm-hmm. And it's just fun to just drink it and talk. We don't even have to get into the details. We can just hang out and drink it.
That's what we signed up here for, folks. So if you're just, you know, at home listening or in the car listening, just know your three dudes are having some great whiskey here. We should actually say we got the Old Crow Traveler Fifth. You know, this, when this came out, you know, vodka was on the rise, and this was thought to be, you know, something that would be a little bit of an answer to the martini crowd, because they would go around with their little their martini kits, go out on the lawn, put their blanket out, and they're listen to the Beatles or whoever, and make their martinis. This was thought to be a little bit of a pushback on that. And then we have this old Heaven Hill here, a 10-year, and we actually have it. This is distilled in 1962, bottled in 1973, and it is a, and you might hear that say like, oh, that's not 10 years old. It's actually, you know, it was distilled in the fall of 62, a bottle in the spring of 72. So it is 10 years old by law.
And it is the bottle and bond that we have here today.
Exactly. It's bottle and bond.
Which you know. I'm very glad to get that bottle.
Yeah. Well, we
might Bernie be proud.
We might be killing it on up and over here. And then we got the one of the first rare breeds that came out. And so rare breed was basically, you know, in the wave of like Booker's and all these other kind of like original small batches. And notorious as they are, the cork broke off on a skinny as I tried to open it with my skilled, like, little side technique. Didn't work. Pushed it right on in.
There's no technique that can get a cork out of a turkey, Dusty, successfully.
It is really hard.
I've never seen it happen. I've never seen anybody successfully take one out.
Those corks,
they always break.
Those corks just get all mushy, you know, or they're all dry. So, like, something to do with the bottling, the proof, and the quality of the cork they used back then, but the damn things always break.
Yep.
Ryan, what's the proof on that one, by the way, for people kind of know what we're
am I going to guess? I'm going to go 112 and some change.
I'm trying to find it. Mm. Oh, here we are. Well, ironically, it's 108.4 proof.
Ah!
Oh, close.
They know that. That's a good proof. They know what they're doing. Somebody else proofs that.
They get a 108 barrel strength over there.
That's right.
It does taste hotter than 108 proof, though. I'm going to tell you right now.
Yeah.
It tastes pretty hot to me.
So I kind of want to get in a little bit to you all, like the allure of Dusties and what makes them so grand. And for anybody I'll tell my story as I start coming to this too. And when I started really getting to bourbon, I know that when I started going on, you know, the different secondary markets, and you see what's out there, and all of a sudden people are selling like old bottles that have, you know, from National Distillers, Old Granddad, and they literally have price tags on them for $7.99, but people are selling them, and this is, let's rewind the clock back to like 2014, 2015 timeframe, and they're selling them for like $199. And I'm like, who the fuck would ever pay $199 for something that used to sit on the shelves for $8 back in the day?
Yeah.
Like, blew my mind. Never thought about it. I'm like, I'm all in with the new, never going to do it. And it actually probably took a solid, probably 1 to 2 years after that for somebody to actually give me my first Dusty pour.
I think it was probably at Whiskey Pig or
Whiskey Pig was your first Dusty.
It wasn't my first one, but it was definitely one of the earlier days.
Yeah. I mean, well, I had had Dusty bourbons, but I hadn't, that was the first time like you had like the really good ones, and you know, you had Bill Thomas there and everybody telling you about them. And you know, at the time, you know, you say it was $200, but to me, I was like,
and that was a steal nowadays, by the way.
You know, this was right when bourbon was starting to really get popular and camping was beginning, you know, limited releases were getting harder to get and you're paying exorbitant amounts for antique and Pappy's and all this. So like, to me, I was Dusty's were kind of like a value opportunity back then. It was like, all right, I can get some that's really good and unique for under a couple hundred bucks. And
it'd be under sub 100.
Yeah. I mean, I remember when I first bought old granddads, I was getting them for like 75 bucks, you know, for, you know, mid 80s, low 80s old granddads. And they were just worth every penny. I mean, they were butterscotch bombs that it tastes just like Werther's. I mean, they're just so pleasant. But,
well, I think anybody who gets into Dusty hunting cannot think about it without remembering seeing the things that are on that you could see on the shelves when you were turning of legal drinking age and you would walk right past it. I remember seeing the veined Wellers. Oh, yes. The veined Wellers. They were still on the shelves in Oklahoma in the late 90s and stuff like that. And you know, I just buy Jim Beam and it's like that stuff I could have bought. I mean, I actually would have had 40 bucks or something where I could have afforded to buy that sort of thing. And I just, you know, you look back to that time, you're like, I wish I had a time machine.
We all wish we had time machine.
Yeah. I wish I had a time machine.
Where's the DeLorean?
I mean, like my dad, I tell this story all the time. He worked for bourbon companies doing like machinery, like gear and tool and die repair. And they were giving bottles, special releases as like Christmas gifts. And I can't tell me Elijah Craig, like 21s, 19s, you know, Noah's Mills, age-stated Rowan Creeks from back in the day that, you know, we would drink. I would just take to like college parties and stuff. And I'm like, God, I was such an asshole. You know, I'm taking these to the parties and like mix them with Coke and stuff. You know, it's so stupid, but you didn't know.
I mean, I don't think anybody knew.
I got into it.
Well, some people knew. Let's put it that way.
I got into it almost immediately when I got into bourbon. Like, you know, professionally.
Was there somebody that kind of like gave you that
yeah, first? Jason Bronner. Jason at Bronner, Bourbon's Bistro.
Yeah.
I would spend a lot of time at Bourbon's Bistro. And I have to tell you, like, I don't think that man ever gets enough credit for what he has done for bourbon, being the first like bourbon themed restaurant in Kentucky. And, you know, I just think the world of Jason. And he would have all of these like decanters, you know, he'd get these Beam decanters. He would get all these old Fitzgeralds. He would get everything. A man would never charge you. You were just sitting there and you would just be drinking with him, talking, you know, Veach would come along sometimes and we would just be sitting there at Bourbon's Bistro or out on his patio and be drinking freaking 1950s Kentucky Tavern and like talking about how good it was in sports. And it was just, I look back on that time of my career and I miss it so much. I miss it so much. But that was where I cut my teeth on Dusty's. And it would lead me to meeting random people in parking lots and literally handing over bags of cash.
Estate sales, you know, showing up to every yard sale in the county.
It's
like, got any bourbon in there?
It could take you down a very weird path. I just miss those times.
Yeah, those are the early Dusty. I mean, yeah, we've been there with Jason, you know, up in his office where all the decanters. I mean, he's such a great host and knows all the history and everything about each one. And so, like, he gets one decanter down and you talk about it for like 30 or 40 minutes and then you move on to the next one. It's a great time. But yeah, I mean, I would say Bill Thomas was probably for me anyways, was kind of...
He was your Sherpa.
He was kind of my Sherpa, you know, in the Dusty Bourbons. And
we're talking about two great Sherpas here.
Oh, for, gosh. You know. I mean, yeah, Bill just gets so excited and animated, you know, when he's talking about it. And I had the lucky opportunity to stay at his house and, you know, drink some of the green glass Van Winkle Rye's, you know, and from Lawrenceburg and stuff. And man, that was like the best, probably the best whiskey I've ever had in my life. And, you know, some people just like old stuff because they just don't like the present, you know, but there is something magical about drinking history, you know, thinking about what was going on in that time, you know, what was going on in the world. And it's just a fascinating thing and something unique you get to experience every time you do this.
Well, and it's also very important for us to talk about the differences in how they were made. Now, a lot of these brands will have the same recipe, but we are looking at, depending on the generation of the time, you're looking at like different water was being used, right? So, and different techniques for the water, you know, so at the very basis of the core of like all the parts of what whiskey is, it was all very different. The corn, if it was pre 1950s, it was non-hybrid corn. Starting into like the 1950s, a little bit in the 40s, you know, after we had so many people starving with the, you know, with the Great Depression and everything in the Dust Bowl, scientists started working on like hybrid corn, which would basically allow the allow farmers to have something that was a little bit more drought resistant. And then so they were breeding corn in labs. You know, that would later turn into genetically modified corn. And, you know, so if we're tasting something pre-1955, really pre-1970, the chances are you were tasting a whiskey that the farmer had actually planted the seeds and had developed the corn strain in his own or her own farm. And that right there, you know, those are two things, you know, the water and the corn being differently. But the most important factor, in my opinion, is the distillation technique. It's the fermentation technique. It's the yeast. And of course, the wood. Most of the wood used for the barrels that
you just basically named off the entire process. Yeah. You're like, basically,
the most important thing is everything.
Oh, okay. Well, I was going to say wood, but then I was like, oh, well, what about the yeast?
Well, no, yeah, this one's important too.
Basically, if you take all of those things, you know, of all of those things being the most important, the wood, we're looking at first growth wood. You know, the wood that's being used right now for barrels, they're being, you know, plucked on private land. You know, they're between 60 and 90 years old. The trees that people were cutting down back then, there's a good chance, man, that a human hadn't seen that tree in the 1940s to 1970s until someone hit it with a chainsaw or a blade. You know, so you're looking at like the very best of oak, different techniques on making whiskey. And also there were no computers. There were no, there was not automation. It was humans doing everything. And then you had some people like Pappy Van Winkle who actually resented the growth of chemists in the industry to the point where he put up signs like no chemists allowed. So there was a lot more attention to human detail than to computer efficiency. You know, so we have seen a lot of changes over the years in terms of like what goes into the bottle. The recipes may be the same. They like to say that at Wild Turkey, and that is true. But there's also been some legal changes that have allowed whiskey to be different. In 1962, they increased the barrel entry proof from 110 from the legal maximum to 125. By increasing it to 125, they could get more volume and basically put out more bottles, thus make more money. It also reduced their tax liability. But there's only a handful of bourbons today that if you were to say like, okay, we're going back to the laws of 1958, it's only a handful of bourbons that would be considered bourbon today. Four Roses, Wild Turkey, everything at Buffalo Trace would not be considered bourbon because none of them are going into the barrel at 110. Baker's Mark, on the other hand, and you know, things like Wilderness Trail, you know, those would be definitely be considered, you know, bourbon because they're going at 110. So there's a lot of production factors that make this whiskey to me always that much more special. And also it is incredibly, incredibly inconsistent. And as I point to the tops here, and that one over there, the enclosures that they used dictate the flavor that we get today. Sometimes that you get a dusty that tastes spot on and it's exactly like it should be. Or sometimes you get one like I had recently with a 1945 Kentucky Tavern. And I mean, it tasted like sweat, leather, and gross. And it's because
yeah, like a gym, if you will.
Like it was just like a gym. And the inside of the cap, you know, if you take a look underneath here, so sometimes you see there's some little plasticky kind of like there's an adhesive there. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's not stored properly, that adhesive gets into the whiskey and you don't want that. It does not taste good. All of those miniature bottles, I used to collect the miniature bottles and you crack those things open, no matter what the whiskey is, it's going to be contaminated from the cap and typically. And so you really do not always get a great experience with the Dusties, but when you do, it's magical. Yeah. It's magical.
So we heard Fred's sort of take on that. It takes everything. Ryan, do you think, mm-hmm. is there one thing that we look at in regards to Dusties? I mean, there's wood, there's corn, there's the water. Like, is there something in your mind that sticks out that is something that might be a little bit more, I guess, forgiving or maybe more influential to that process?
I think it's oxygen has, I don't know this exact percentage, but you got to think that oxidizing is playing a huge role in these, you know, as we've seen, this cork was not meant to age, you know, the bottles, the seals and stuff. So oxygen's getting in there and changing the liquid. Stuff's evaporating, stuff's moving around, you know, and I think that I've had it happen with, you know, newer bottles that I've.
You got to remember, a lot of people used to call this stuff rot gut. Right. Back in the day, they'd be like, yeah. 70s, 80s, like, I'm not drinking, this is rot gut
stuff. Oh,
yeah. And we're like, oh, give us more.
Well, I think it's brand dependent on that, but, you know, oxidation, man, absolutely. It's all about the fit of the cork or whatever. And if you see it, you know, significantly below the neck, stay the heck away from that. Don't buy it, right?
Yeah.
And it, a lot of that is like, you know, when I was amassing a library, I would always, the questions I would ask would be about storage. And one time I found out a lady like was storing her stuff next to the kitty litter, like her cats. I was like, I am not buying anything that's been stored next to kitty litter.
Yeah. And too, like if you ever leave like, you know, leave a glass full of bourbon, you know, out and you go taste it the next day, it doesn't taste as hot or, you know, the alcohol's, you know, it's mellowed out drastically.
You don't put it straight in the dishwasher?
I've always just tried it just to see what it tastes.
You're a little science experiment.
I brush my teeth with it. I mean, it's, you know.
Not all the time, but I'm like, well, what does this taste like, you know, after it's set out all night? And it definitely loses. So, because a lot of these older whiskeys were younger. Now, some were older, but I think, too, the oxygen kind of calms that, you know, the hot aspect or the graininess of it or corn. That's just a theory. But, you know, just from me observing, me leaving my bourbon glass out after a long night.
It is true. I mean, when you, I think the only bottle up here that's probably on the opposite side of that is this Old Heaven Hill. That's a 10-year. But a lot of times the dusty-ish era, it was 4 to 6-year-old whiskey. Like that was a pretty normal thing back then. And now I think we're kind of like seeing a little bit more of the rise of that because we do see a lot more whiskey coming out at a much younger age. But you do see a lot of stuff that was, you know, whether it was, you know, Bourbon Deluxe. And a lot of things that were coming out of national distillers at the time, they were
granddad was, yeah. You know, forward.
By the way, Bourbon Deluxe, if you're, that's a great value dusty that you can get and people don't respect it. That's a good one.
I respect. If you have any, call me.
Call us. Yeah.
I mean,
I know we're in the middle of the interview and I know want to get down this. Old Crow is so amazing.
It's fantastic.
This Old Crow is like, it's like butter on my palate.
And every time I have dusties, like we all have our favorites and, you know, usually whatever you're drinking at the time is your favorite, but I go back and forth between the Dusty Turkeys and National Distiller. And when I drink this Old Crow, I'm like, gosh, National Distiller, I'm just so sad you're not here anymore.
I know. it's like
everything I have from there has been just,
they were amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, if this came out today, this would be the best whiskey on the shelf.
Oh, I mean, hands down.
It says right on the back, says 4/5 corp. And this whiskey is 4 years old.
Yep.
Right there on there. From the Old Crow Distillery, Frankfort, Kentucky, Louisville, Kentucky.
It's just got
90 proof.
I mean, look at that color, though. It doesn't look like a 4-year-old. That's amazing color.
So here's the other thing that people also talk about with dusties, and maybe it could be true, was maybe it was during the glut era. And knowing that you weren't going to go and change a bunch of labels and do all this, you had all these older stocks. And so people were putting older stocks of whiskey that could have been 8, 10, 12, 15 years old into a 4-year-old bottle, and it didn't really matter because back at the time nobody cared about high age dating.
Yeah, I mean that's the standard for old whiskey back then was 8 years old. If something was north of 8 years old, they would look at it. You know, the consumers would not look at it, you know, positively. And I think in an interview with Bernie Lubbers, he talked about his old man talking about that. And you can watch movies like The Hustler, and they reference 8-year-old bourbon. And you didn't really see the glut effect in terms of like that sort of thing until you got into the 70s. But you would not see many barrels north of 10 years old in this time. Now, during Prohibition, you would see a lot of like 17, you know.
Yeah, because we've seen the Taylors, you know, yeah, that are like 17, 18.
That they were just putting them out there. They were just putting anything out during Prohibition or right before Prohibition when they knew. They're like, well, shit, we're not going to get any money during Prohibition. Mm-hmm. Let's sell it now. You know, so it was such a different time. And the area, it's funny, like, I don't know if you plan to go there, Kenny, but what the area that I tell people to really stay away from, unless they're a serious collector, is the Prohibition medicinal area. Because one, there's a lot of fakes that got out during that time. And two, they just did not care about the quality of the whiskey. It was just to get it out so people could have some medicinal whiskey, and it was just not the same level.
Yeah, I feel like it's too risky.
it is a really risky time period, especially if you want to drink it. I've had a lot of stuff from like the 1800s. You know, I've had stuff from pretty much every period, and I get brought in by auction houses to validate bottles and, you know, to give stories on them. And, you know, the thing about those eras is that they're not modern fakes. Like, bootleggers of the time were faking the stuff.
Right.
And they weren't faking it with like, oh, by the way, we're faking it with a nice touch of Stutzweller and a little bit of Wild Turkey. No, I mean, they're putting like...
In our own PVC capsule.
Yeah.
With our own heat gun. We're just...
They're doing it with kerosene. So, and there were times that too, they would bottle piss. You know, so there would be like fake bottles in there. You know, so you...
People always want the old days come out. I'm like, no. Stories like that, I'm like, we're doing just fine right now.
Yeah. So, you know, that era is risky. But like, if you know, like there was somebody who found a bunch of bottles in their house, and it made it all over the news recently. And I looked up who lived there, and I looked up what brand it was, and it was the most like counterfeited brand in Canada of the time. And it was a Scotch. I can't remember the name of the Scotch. And it happened to be, and the guy happened to be like in Northern New York. So, you know, he's obviously got a pipeline into Canada. I was like, I would not touch those bottles with a 10-foot pole. This is a known like counterfeiter at the time, a bootlegger, and this is the most bootleg brand of that time, and yeah, so you got to be careful when you're going prior to the regulatory years of whiskey.
So on that note, let's kind of talk about dusty hunting or the days that used to be dusty hunting, because I know that, I mean, even when I got into it back in, you know, 2014 timeframe, there was an opportunity, but even then, even in Kentucky, there were people way ahead of me, you know, Larry Rice's Silver Dollar, the Justins, like you name it, that had already cleared the shelves out of Kentucky. You didn't really stand a chance. And I didn't have the hindsight, or should I say foresight at the time, when I was doing a lot of travel, even domestically, internationally, to actually go and search for this stuff. Would have been a perfect opportunity to do it. But I mean, is it fair to say that pretty much every store, every shelf has been cleaned in the United States at this point? Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. And with Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. And you can get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/bourbon, all lowercase, and go to shopify.com/bourbon to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/bourbon. If you're anything like me, then you can't get enough about bourbon. And that's why I'm a subscriber to Bourbon Plus magazine. Bourbon Plus is a quarterly publication that tells the stories from the heart of bourbon, the farmers who grow the grain, the distillers who labor over the process, and the people, like you and me, who raise their glasses to celebrate it all. Subscribe to Bourbon Plus magazine today at bourbonplus.com, that's PLUS.com, and use code PURSUIT at checkout for $5 off your subscription. Is it fair to say that pretty much every store, every shelf has been cleaned in the United States at this point? Like,
I don't think so. I think that I mean, and you all do too. I get probably 10 emails a week of someone inheriting their family's whatever, and there'll be a case down there. Oh, I didn't even know grandma drank, and she's got 6 bottles of Old Fitzgerald, you know, from 1955. Are those worth anything? Why?
Oh, well, that's one thing. Yeah.
I'm talking about in liquor stores.
I'm talking about like you going, like you driving around middle of Kansas and you're like, oh.
I don't consider those Dusties.
Well, I mean, that's these were all found on the shelf at some point, you know? Yeah. And okay. And so if you're looking, I mean, we'll say.
Like Larry Rice would tell the story of, yeah, going into a liquor store and be like, got anything that's hadn't sold in the back? And yeah, there'd be like case upon case of Granddad or something, you know, from back in the.
From the National Distillers
yeah.
time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I
guess we should also clarify what we consider Dusties versus what other people consider Dusties, what yeah. you consider Dusties.
Yeah, yeah. I think that, you know, anything like pre-1995, you know, is like, would be a Dusty. And then after that, you have kind of like a contemporary Dusty period from 96 to 2005. And then after that, it's like, it's, if it's within 15 years, I don't consider that a Dusty.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm probably the same. I might go 99 and before, but yeah, anything at least before 2000, I think, is considered Dusty for me.
I'd say 2000 is a pretty good year.
Yeah.
I mean, because usually when somebody says the word pre-fire, you're like, oh, 96. Like, you know exactly when that is.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think that's probably a good qualifier. That would fit within the range. But, you know, there are some... You know, there's also the regulatory years, like you have like everything that's on a like a stamp is all of this is regulated, right? But there was a time when the bottle and the whiskey and all that was not regulated. And so you wouldn't see proofs on there. You wouldn't. And so like until the Pure Food and Drug Act, you wouldn't see much information on the label at all. You know, so I think the bottle is a story in itself and an evolution, and that's how you're able to identify.
Why did they stop with like the tax stamps? Because I really enjoy them because it gives you like a clear day to you don't have to
That was under the Reagan administration. When President Reagan took office, he began a slew of deregulation, and Reagan believed that the alcohol industry needed to be deregulated at the same time as the utility industry and the airline industry and a couple others. And all those industries were like, yes, deregulate us, woohoo! And then like the alcohol industry was like, please, no, keep these laws in effect. This helps us. They liked the idea of having an extra government employee there. You know, they looked at that as like they were helping. They weren't really making much of an impact on, you know, they weren't hurting them, they were helping them. Mistakes didn't happen because of that. And then they would testify before Congress that if you take away the government oversight, then you're going to start seeing people get deceived by poor labeling and advertising. Everything they said in that time in the early 80s has, you know, come to fruition to be right. And the one thing that they all agreed upon pretty much was the tax stamp, because they were clunky. A lot of them would get lost in the mail. They did a study where they cost like the government like $15 million a year because the government actually printed it like they do money and issued them out. And so they had to recirculate them all the time. And it was very laborsome intensive. And so that was like one area where they kind of all agreed on was like, all right, let's get rid of the tax stamp. And
they all printed on codes on all of them and everything like that. Printed on codes and dates. I mean, they all changed over the years as well.
I mean, Reagan basically brought a blowtorch to a lot of government procedures, and then that basically was the death knell to it. And once the brands didn't have to have the tax stamp on there anymore, they're like, hey, that was one thing that is never going to come back. And the only time you'll see it, if it's fanciful. And, you know, sadly...
Like what, McKenna puts it on there?
Mm-hmm. Yep. McKenna does. E.H. Taylor. You know, I think Saffel does. I think Greenbrier does. I'm just looking at Kenny's shelf, actually.
Oh, yeah, you got cheat sheet. I was like, damn, you can name all these stuff.
It's one way to do it.
But you have, it's funny to me. It was Norton Simon's CEO, which is who operated Sitzaweller at the time, basically predicted all of the transgressions we have seen in labeling in like 1981 in those testimony periods. But yeah, so that's I don't even know what the question was. It got me down that rant. But
is there any more bourbon hunting left?
Yeah, I think we were talking about, yeah, is there
You all know how I am. I get all excited and talk about tax day.
We'll bring it back somehow. Fred throws it off course, and then I just add fuel to the fire by asking questions about him throwing it off course.
Kenny's like looking at a spreadsheet. Yeah. Guys, no. Like,
this outline says topic this now at this time stamp.
Yeah, you got me there. Oh, well.
So I do. I definitely think there is bourbon hunting still in stores. Is it rampant? Absolutely not. You gotta work for it, and you're gonna have to go in the seedy parts of town sometimes.
Yeah, you have to go to rural areas
that you may not want to go into. This is the forgotten part of bourbon hunting, and I'm about to let loose one of my secrets, and that is going into bars, old bars that look like shit. You might get your ass kicked, but if you start that conversation by putting a 20. Or, you know, on the table, like, hey, I'm just curious, you got any cases back there? They're not going to, I mean, those places will have nooks and crannies of where they've had cases back there.
You know, it's funny you say that. I've had good luck at country clubs, you know, like old country clubs where they've had bourbon. And you're like, I went to Owensboro Country Club and they had a vintage 21-year rye on the bar. And they're like, yeah, we got a couple in the back too. Nobody's ever drank in 30 years, you know? And you're like, what?
Wow.
And, you know, that's happened at multiple country clubs where, you know, people think it's rock good or 90 good. And, you know, it just stays back in the liquor storage.
Well, that's good. I mean, and that is the type of an audience that the distributors and the bar owners want to get high end stuff, but they're not educated about what's in the bottle. And what a great place to hunt, country clubs. Now, you have to be a member to get into these places. I mean, I'm not a member of a country club, so.
I was a guest. So
I
just popped in like.
So that's
just walk in like you belong.
That's a new strategy right there.
It is.
And they ask you for a code or like your member number. Just say like, 1458.
Thompson.
Yeah.
So I guess that kind of brings up another good thing. And Fred, you're going to go last on this because you'll probably beat both of us here. But Ryan, what's your best ever Dusty score?
Dusty score? Oh, gosh. I mean, I was just...
I mean, that one, the country club, was pretty good. I remember you telling me...
Yeah,
like, you were like, just fill up this flask.
Well, the ironic thing is they wouldn't sell it to me. So they were like, I won't buy... They won't sell you the whole entire bottle, but they'll sell you about it. They were like, it was an open bar. And they were like, well, we'll just serve it to you by the drink. And I was like, well, I want 4 shots, you know, and so they pour them up and I go out to my bag and fill my flask up and like 4 more until I got my flask full. But man, gosh, dusty bottles. I mean, I don't know. My favorite is anything 83 to like 86 old granddad. I just have a soft spot in my heart for those. Those are like my favorite ones. They're so good.
You're not wrong, man. They are so good.
There's never
been a bad one.
I don't have any like cool unicorn green glass Van Winkles or anything like that. I had one of those cool Heaven Hill bottles that kind of came in that decanter with the horse on it. I had one. You had a David Hobbs' house with us. I did have one of those. That was probably my most unique or rare one. But yeah, the old granddad's always anything National Distiller. Like I'm like doing cartwheels because I got them.
You know, Fred brought up the kind of anecdote about.
Oh, I did have a Chessman. That was.
Oh okay. Story.
That's a big one.
Yeah, I had a Chessman, the Queen, but it's gone now. So
where's the story? Yeah, how'd you get it?
I got it at an estate sale. I would go, you know, after the Whiskey Pig event. I started, you know, and Bill Thomas like talking about. I went to estate sales and stuff. I would. Getting Carrier Journal, look at the classifieds and go to estate sales. And I found it. I think I paid like $30 for it.
That's a score right there.
Yeah.
$30 is a great score.
Given I gave $700 for an entire set, absolutely. No, $7,000.
I was about to say
$7,000. $7,000.
I was like,
with the rug and everything?
I was like, you went on that one. Yeah, I would say so. Mine is to kind of follow what Fred had talked earlier about how every week there's somebody that finds a case of something in grandma's basement. And I was always like, how come like that never happens to me? Like I've never like had to go to a family's house and then they just got, oh, you know, it's Christmas time. We'll go in there and see what, you know, great uncle Joe has underneath of his cabinet. And oh, what do you know? There's this whole plethora of like dusty turkey. Never happened to me. So my grandmother-in-law, Lauren's grandma, she was moving out of her house and moving into an assisted living facility. And of course, me being me, going over there to like help clean out the house. What's the first thing I do? I run to the liquor cabinet and
real nice.
Yeah, I know. And I was just like, oh, I'll start looking around and I start pulling around. And she had bottles, like she had gin bottles that were labeled, like had painter's tape on them that said like vodka on them. Like she was like reusing.
It's funny, like a ton of state sales, they always had gin, like a ton of gin bottles. That and vermouth. It was like, why don't y'all have some? I guess they drink a lot of martinis.
Maybe a martini.
It was that. And I lifted up a few bottles and some were like liqueur bottles and they're all cloudy and all this other kind of stuff. And then I see this kind of like purple and gold box and it says Rebel Yell on the top. And I'm like, I start lifting up. I was like, oh God, it feels full. Please, please be sealed. Please be sealed. Please be sealed. I open it up, 1970s Rebel Yell, Stitzel Weller. And I was just like, it finally happened to me. This has never happened to me before. So I went to grandma and I said, grandma, like, I'll give you like $400 or $500 for this. Like, I want to offer you something fair. She was like, oh, Kenny, I'll never drink this. Just have it. And I'm like, okay. Like, yeah. Before anybody else in the family said, I'm like, run out to the cart, put it in there. Like, so yeah, it was probably the, you know, free, but it was also really nice because coming down from a family member.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So for me, it's not, you know, full disclosure. I get retained to professionally go do this and buy things and,
yeah, and give me some more of that old crow. That shit's
unbelievable, right? So I have to, you know, you can go take a look at the Bardstown Bourbon Company's vintage library, which I curated.
We should talk about that after you finish your story.
You know, I've got an 1892 whiskey in there. I've got some 1906 stuff. Yeah, I've got the entire Chesticanner piece in there. But the story I will give will be one that I did for me personally, and I still have these bottles. And I've been on the hunt for a particular Dowling, an 8-year-old Dowling bottled in bond, since I wrote my book Whiskey Women, because Mary Dowling played a huge part of that book. And you know, when she moved, she and her family moved their Waterfill and Fraser distillery to Mexico, effectively starting to create Mexican bourbon. Prior to Prohibition, I mean, they would alter the course of bourbon history and are the main reasons why bourbon became a unique product of the United States is that they got, you know, the Kentucky distillers got tired of seeing this Mexican bourbon on the market. And so I've always been on the hunt for Mexican bourbon. That was always very special to me. And I happened to find a bottle finally. And I spent probably more than I should, which is often the story when you find a bottle you want, right? You get overzealous about it and you get very excited and you're like, you know what? I will pay that.
Yeah.
You know, you don't think with your pocketbook, you think with another part of your brain. And I get the bottle, so excited about it. I crack it open, I taste it, and it was one of the top five worst tasting things I'd ever had in my life.
No.
You know. But it was made at that distillery in Mexico. It was a Mexican bourbon. I had gotten it. It was one of my top ones to hunt. And then I got it. And then sometime later, I got a Dowling bourbon from when they made it. They put their name back on some Kentucky products. And, you know, that one too was a hunt. It was a guy who was in his family was in the distilling industry and his dad, grandpa was like a master distiller. But I was able to obtain a great deal of Dowling products and new make fresh off the still in the 1940s. So
that is a true unicorn. That is cool. That is a true unicorn.
That just brought up a story in my head to think about. I probably should have told this for my cool story. But my dad and his property is on an old distillery. Like it used to be the original Willett distillery there in Bardstown off Nazareth Road. Now Heaven Hill owns the warehouses, and I think Old Tubbs like building their new distillery there or something now. But anyways, there was this brand called Stephen Foster was in a fiddle bottle.
You
know, and we used to find them all over the property because the lake we used to be to feed the distillery. We used to find them, but they're all shattered. I could never find one that was full or anything. But then online, there was this guy that had one, and you know, he wanted like $500 for it, and I was like, that's a lot of money, you know, at the time. And you know, I overpaid for it, but he's like, well, I'll give you a miniature too. You know, and I was like, oh, that's great. And so I gave it to my dad for Father's Day present. And
Did he shatter it in the backyard?
Join the rest of them.
It's still sitting on a shelf that we opened the little miniature to try it. And it was one of the, it was terrible. Like, it just tasted like dog shit.
Yeah. And that's, and I think that's one of the,
but it's cool
lessons.
That we have a full bottle that we can put on the shelves, but we know never not to drink it. Or maybe it was the glue Dusty. That got
it
in there.
It could be the glue because it was a miniature.
Yeah.
But one of the great lessons in Dusty's is like, it is a crapshoot. It is an absolute crapshoot. And I would say you hit on greatness 20% of the time. You hit on mediocrity, you know, after that 20%. So 30%. So I would say half of it is drinkable. The other half, buckle up. It is not drinkable. But you always have a story. And if you don't mind parting money with your story, kind of like playing blackjack or craps or whatever, then go for it. And I will say that rye tends to keep better than bourbon. And I think that is a story for another time.
Yeah, I think we'll have to, because I don't think I've had a dusty rye before, now that I think about it. I've had dusty.
We had the Rittenhouse rye.
Oh, but is the Rittenhouse rye really a dusty bourbon? That just came
out. Pre 2000s.
Well, yeah.
I guess it was distilled pre 2000s.
21, 23, 25 year. But
are you talking about those single barrels from back in the day?
Yeah.
Those were amazing.
I know. Those are magical.
Yeah, but those were. They didn't spend 30 years in a glass bottle being oxidized or anything.
Or if you've had the green glass Van Winkle rye from the medley stuff, oh man, that's
The
nectar of the gods.
The Van Winkle stuff, that was when I was building that collection at Bardstown. That was goal one, full chest of canner peat that are set. Goal two, all the Van Winkles.
They got some special Van Winkles there.
And you know, they really were not that hard to obtain. That was not much of a hunt. That was going to someone I knew who had them.
Because it was you and Bill that curated that, right? That whole
Well, I bought a lot off of Bill. Yeah, Bill was was very, very kind to release a few, but it definitely, so the story, my favorite story from that collection is the Chest of Canner series. This was all obtained legally. But you have to show, if you're selling to someone, you have to show your license. And the person we bought it from didn't want to show her license. And the transaction has to take place in the facility. And, you can't look at a decanter. I happen to have all the weights of every one of the chess pieces before empty and then full. So I would weigh every one of them. I was like, listen, I'm not paying you $7,000. If they're
some of these are empty,
I was sure. Like, so we're weighing them, and she's over here like fidgeting, all nervous, and the majority were full, and so she got her check, but it was a very weird experience. So, but it was all legit, legal, everything, real person,
and the whiskey checks out, and that's what matters.
I had a Chessman last time I was at BBC. It tasted just like I remembered.
Yeah, I regret ever telling anybody that was the greatest bourbon I'd ever tasted.
Yeah, you did that a long time ago, and then all of a sudden that became one of the crown jewels of Dusty's was that.
I did it on BBC. I don't know why, but this guy asking me in his British accent, and yes, sir, tell us what is your favorite bourbon you've ever had? No one's ever been able to get that out of me. And that guy just asked me in that way, and I'm like, oh, definitely the Old Crow chest canner piece. And what was it about that you loved? And I just went on about the whole story, and then boom, it was on Reddit.
Fred's heart is a British accent.
I know.
Yeah. It gets me every time.
So one last question before we kind of throw this out, because I know that in the 70s, we talked about earlier, the beam decanters and everything like that. There's always been this thing of like, if you get it, decant it real quick and then drink it, because people are like, oh, it's going to leach
lead poison,
lead into it and stuff like that. Now, I've tried a bunch. I don't think I've tasted lead. I haven't gotten myself checked out.
Maybe that's what's wrong with us.
Maybe that's what it is. Just micro doses of lead poisoning. Is that what it is?
Well, I think from a liability perspective, I think it's very important for us to note that we are not doctors by any means.
We did stay at a Holiday Inn last
night. And you should, if you are to get in this game, and it makes, and you should have it tested for lead with the little strips that you can buy at like Lowe's or something like that. But with that said, most of the ones that always come up, the whiskey's just not good anyway. The decanters don't really hold them well. And you talk to like Bill Thomas, he's like, I don't buy decanters. Like decanters are the, they're very.
Except the Chessmen.
Except the Chessmen. And again, I have the weights of all the Chessmen, but that's why they are so, you can't trust them. It's the evaporation because you cannot see inside the bottle. And that's why today I get so pissed off at like the colored bottles. Like I want to be able to see what's inside the bottle. And the evaporation and all that stuff is real. The cork never holds in good. It's not a good fitting. And, you know, if it's stored in the wrong place, boom. It's just, it's not going to be good whiskey.
There you go.
Now we're
coming from an expert.
And we know it. We know it. Well, guys, this was a fun episode talking about Dusty. This is something I've been wanting to do for a long time. And the fact that we got three really good Dusties to drink while we're doing it makes it all much better.
Good.
God, that Old Crow was
good. Yeah, Old Crow stands above.
I'll tell you what, I'm still a big fan of this Old Heaven Hill over
here.
Yeah,
the Old Crow, the Heaven Hill, and then the, sorry, Rare Bird, that the Rare Breed was.
It was still good,
It was still really good, though.
Yeah, I know. It's still really good.
Yeah, the Rare Breed was good, but it was a distant third for me.
So, well, guys, this was fun. Again, great episode on talking about Dusty's, Dusty hunting, aspects of why we think Dusty's taste different. And if you want us to taste your Dusty's, make sure you you reach out to us. We'll be very open.
Yes, we'll validate all Dusty's.
Oh, Fred got a kick out of this one, didn't he?
He did.
He chuckles over here. But with that, I want to say thank you everybody for tuning in. Make sure you subscribe wherever you listen. Make sure you subscribe to Fred Minnick, where you get all your Fred Minnick news. And with that, cheers, everybody. We'll see you all next week.
Vodka sucks.
Toodles.